Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to 10% Happier early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I'll be totally honest. I didn't know much about Duncan Sheik. I'm a pretty big music fan, but he had somehow escaped my notice. I had heard Barely Breathing, I guess, when his big hit back in the 90s, but I was too busy listening to Pavement and other indie rock bands, so he never really got onto my radar in a big way. But then somebody recently pointed out to me that he's a meditator. In fact, he's been doing it for a while, and it's been a big part of his creative process. So we invited him to come in, and he did, and I was super impressed and charmed by the guy, and I think you will be too. So I give you Duncan Sheik.
From ABC, this is the 10% Happier Podcast. I'm Dan Harris.
Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks
really
for
appreciate
having
it.
Me. Yeah.
My wife was psyched when I told her that you were coming on
nice.
The show. She didn't know until this morning. She's like, what? You got Duncan Sheik on the show?
Tell her I say hi.
I will. She's very rarely impressed with me, so this was a win.
I'm sure that's not true.
No, it's definitely true. So how did you become a Buddhist?
I went to Brown University. And my freshman year, I was taking a bunch of classes about Eastern religions kind of generally. And I was just, I think I had been interested in it in high school and, kind of lapsed Catholic, pretty, standard, typical story of like when I was 14 or 15, I just basically started to not buy into the dogma. The summer between my freshman and sophomore year, I went to LA to visit a relative of mine, actually my mother's cousin, and she had been practicing Buddhism since the early 70s, and specifically with the Soka Gakkai. So she had been
Soka Gakkai,
which is it's sort of the lay Buddhist organization of Nichiren Buddhism, which is the Japanese form of Buddhism that I practice. And basically, you chant Nam-myoho Renge Kyo. So that's the essential part of the practice.
You just run that. You chant what?
Nam-myoho Renge Kyo.
And you chant it aloud or internally?
You chant it aloud. You have a mandala, which is called a gohanzen, and sort of set up in an altar. So every morning and evening, I'll chant for maybe, sometimes it's 15 minutes, sometimes, hopefully, it's an hour. Sometimes it's even longer, but depending on what's going on in my day and my life, I chant, every morning and every evening. And it's, been a daily practice of mine since I was 19.
How do your neighbors feel about this?
they can't hear it. It's quite subtle. But it's interesting because when I started practicing, I was 19, and I had been playing music for a long time, but I was an incredibly self-conscious performer and singer. And there was something about chanting where you're just kind of sitting on one note kind of continually that really taught me how to sing one note. And I think there's something great about if you know how to sing one note, then possibly you can learn how to sing two notes and then maybe three and then maybe four. And there was something really great about using my voice in this very calm and specific way that helped me a lot. In terms of becoming somebody who could actually get on stage and sing.
But I have a million questions.
Yeah.
But let me start with this. When I was, I say this all the time when I meet people who started practicing either meditation or Buddhism or both early. Because when I was 19, I was an idiot and a jerk. And if somebody had said, yeah, you should start chanting this thing, I would have been like, yeah, go pound sand. No way.
Yes.
So what about you allowed that idea to lodge itself in your brain?
Well, okay. It's a great question. Because I also felt the same way. I wouldn't say I was a total idiot, but I was sort of a snob. I was like an intellectual snob about religion. And I just felt like, you can't. I liked the Krishnamurti idea that there was no particular practice that anyone should be following. You just sort of like perceived stuff, through the ether. I don't know what I was thinking. But I had this series of arguments with my mother's cousin while I was staying there in L.A. Basically, she said to me, look, you know, you can study Buddhism all you want and you can understand the intellectual precepts of it all you want. And that's fine. That's positive. But unless you sit down and practice, it's not going to have any real powerful effect on your life. You know, it's not going to change. It's not going to change your karma. It's not going to change your kind of, you know, your mission, your destiny, so to speak. So I sort of took that as a challenge, I guess. And so I sat down and I said, okay, well, I'll chant and I'll see what happens and I'll let you know, you know. And so I think the first day I sat down, I chanted for like 2 hours, which is a really long time to be doing that the first time. And my aunt was very sweet. She was sort of like, okay, I think that's like enough for today. but I do have to say I it was subtle. It wasn't this like, you know, aha moment. But I did feel this kind of sense of, I don't know, hopefulness and also a sense of like creative energy that seemed to be kind of welling up and excitement about possibilities in the future. You know, and this is, you know, as a 19-year-old where I didn't know that much about Buddhism, it was just more a feeling. So that's where it started. I, you know, have been pretty consistent since then.
And how, do you sit in a interesting way, or can you just sit in a chair?
You can sit in a chair, but I kneel. You know, like if I'm doing, like I try to do some yoga as well. So if I'm, you know, if my yoga practice is pretty good, I sit kind of in Virasana, I guess is the position you would call it, and you know, chant for however long I feel I need to. And believe me, it's like, it's sort of like running or like anything else, like in a way, like the more you can chant for 10 minutes and it's good, it kind of gets your blood pumping, so to speak. But if you do it for an hour, it has a much more intense effect.
I'm curious about the effect because as a meditator, I know what meditation does for you. I mean, I think I do sort of basic mindfulness meditation, which is the beginning practice that I think most people who bump up against Buddhism are taught, which is, you know, watch your breath, and when you get distracted, start again.
Is it Vipassana?
Or insight meditation.
Yeah, okay.
So, I mean, I get the for beginners, the fruit of the practice really is you see A, that your mind's out of control, and you see B, that there's a mechanism for training it to be more focused and less yanked around by your emotions.
Right.
Not complicated.
Yeah.
I don't really understand what chanting does for you. Sure. And even though I'm no longer 19, I'm 45,
yeah,
I'm still kind of an idiot and a jerk. And like my reflexive response to the idea of chanting is negative.
Right. I totally understand that. And I, you know, as somebody who watches endless amounts of Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins and all the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, I do understand that impulse very well about like, oh, this is sort of mystical, magical mumbo jumbo. I get it. But I will say that, you know, Nam-myoho Renge Kyo, well, first, it's a kind of a rhythmic thing. So there is something that does happen, I think, physiologically when you're kind of in that rhythm and you're chanting that thing. It changes how you breathe. I think it changes many things about your, just how, you know, how your whole body is functioning, how the relationship of your brain to your heart, to you know, your whole circulatory system. So I do think that it has a really positive aspect in that regard. Also, like, I think of it like Nam-myoho Renge Kyo to me is like, it's kind of like, I think of it, there are these laws that govern the universe. There's gravity, there's electromagnetism, there's, you know, the second law of thermodynamics, you know, nothing is ever created or destroyed. Nam-myoho Renge Kyo, to Buddhists, is sort of like this law that underlies all the kind of, the, it's like the law of cause and effect. So you're getting in rhythm with that huge kind of force, so to speak.
Is there an element of mindfulness to it? You know, I view mindfulness, there are a lot of ways to define it, but I view it as just the mental skill that you can train to see what's happening in your mind without getting carried away by it. And I found that to be remarkably useful, especially like in marriage.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I do think there's an element of that. I think for me, I use the practice as a way of focusing on, you know, how can I create value in the world, in society? How can I create value for myself, for the people in my environment, and, you know, within the culture? You know, as somebody who makes art for a living, how can I do that in the best way possible? That's what chanting gives me.
I don't know, obviously, I think my questions are demonstrating how little I know about Nichi Ren Buddhism. So it's Japanese, it's not Zen, though.
No.
And
yeah, Nichi Ren was sort of a competitor is the wrong word, but he was a Buddhist reformer. Buddhism in Japan in the Middle Ages was mostly practiced by kind of aristocrats and priests, kind of quite frankly, kind of corrupt priesthood, who was, you know, the typical thing of administering expensive funerals and, you know, bestowing talismans on aristocrats who would pay them a lot of money, and it was sort of a racket. And so Nichi Ren was this reformer who kind of came in and said, Buddhism is for everybody. You know, it's for the common people. It's for women. You know, it was a very shocking idea at the time. And he was, you know, he was persecuted and he was castigated and he remonstrated with the government. He's a really interesting historical figure. But, you know, this form of Buddhism that he originated, it wasn't practiced by very many people for 700 years. It wasn't until the kind of 1930s in Japan where a group of educators, this guy Tsunesbero Makoguchi, he kind of popularized the practice, and it really took off in pre-World War II Japan. And especially after World War II, it really took off because the country was decimated and people were really looking for something, you know, to kind of pull themselves out of that situation. So it has a pretty fascinating history.
You ever think you could write a play about it?
Well, it's funny. I mean, the thought has crossed my mind, but it's such a big, huge, grand topic that I feel like it's something I should do when I'm like 70 or something, you know, when I'm...
Isn't all great theater big, huge, grand topics?
Sometimes,
not all, but a
sometimes,
lot.
Sometimes, yeah, it can be. It can be about, I don't know. That's another conversation. But theater, I think, can really be about anything.
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah,
another area where I know basically zilch, which will become evident as we start talking about theater eventually.
I'm sure not.
No. Be sure, yes. But back to your practice. I practice, as we said, Vipassana. One of the most interesting things for me is the marriage of the actual meditation practice and the intellectual infrastructure, you know, reading books about it, listening to talks.
Yes.
So how much of that is there in Nichi Ren?
There's a fair amount. I mean, there's the Gosho, which are kind of like the collected writings of Nichi Ren Daishonin. And most of them are letters that he kind of wrote to his followers. And in those letters, you have... all of this kind of amazing, very frankly, very deep wisdom that, you know, you have to understand it in its cultural context, of course, but it's really profound stuff. And I do feel like I've benefited a lot from spending time with those writings. But there's also, you know, it's a lay Buddhist organization. So, you know, once a month, I get together with a group of, you know, 20 or 30 fellow Buddhists, and we meet in somebody's apartment. In fact, you know, it's somebody who lives on Wall Street. But there's, you know, 30 of us get together, and we're from all different parts of New York City and all different walks of life. And, you know, it's every different ethnicity. It's actually really great because it's the one time where I'm in a room with, like, you know, Asian people, black people, Hispanic people, white people, all different, you know, walks of life, and we're all there kind of for the same reason. So it's a really cool thing.
And do you chant together?
Yeah, you chant, you do gongyo together, you chant a bit, and then people, you know, they talk about their experiences, what's going on in their life and how Buddhism affects their life. And we talk a little bit about doctrine. I sort of wish the conversation would be, it's, I wish, sometimes I wish it would get a little more theoretical, but because it tends to stay pretty general because it's kind of for people who are just starting to practice. But it's great. And I always leave, you know, I leave those meetings feeling really positive and really, you know, like I've learned something about these people who I never otherwise would have hung out with.
How loud is the chant? You say it's subtle, but I mean, is it?
If you're chanting by yourself, it's not very loud at all, obviously. But if you're in a room with 400 people, it's, you know, it's loudish, but it's, you know, it's not crazy.
So you could do it in the next room, and your girlfriend would not be perturbed by it.
Yeah, and in fact, I really like chanting alone. I mean, I'm an only child, so I like to do a lot of things alone. So I really like to just practice on my own, and that tends to be how I practice. But when I'm with, you know, 20 people or 300 people, and we're all chanting, it can be a really cool experience as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I think group practice of any sort has a certain potency to it.
Yeah.
No question about it.
But I do understand this thing of like, oh, why, you know, you're chanting these syllables that are kind of, you know, some medieval dialect of Japanese from the 13th century. Like, what does that have to do with, you know, with anything in our contemporary life? I understand that question. And, you know, there is an aspect of it that is mysterious, and I can only just say that it, you know, that it has had a really profound effect on my life, because when I, you know, when I started practicing, I was 19. Like, I literally could not get on stage and sing an entire song in front of an audience without, you know, collapsing, without like melting. And 7 years after I started practicing, you know, I had a Grammy nomination as, you know, for best male pop singer. You know, it was just completely like it had a very profound effect
on my life. That all on the practice?
I don't pin it all on the practice,
because your innate talent certainly played a role.
Well, but I don't think that I would have gotten to that place if I didn't have this, you know, there's kind of this sense of this like never give up spirit that the practice kind of embodies in you.
Really? Because that's interesting, because that's not what I would describe as the impact of doing straight up mindfulness.
Mm-hmm. I think Nichiren Buddhism is much more, what's the word? It's much more about daily life and about creating value. And I think whereas like Zen Buddhism, for example, you know, is more about, oh, I'm going to like kind of erase my ego and kind of calm down the you know, the voices in my head and kind of back away from that. Nichiren Buddhism is like very engaged kind of in daily life, but not in a sense of like proselytizing or anything, but just in a sense of the things that you're doing, are they creating value for the people in your environment?
Is it engaged in the world in the sense that people are using it so that they're more successful?
I do think that has happened quite a bit, and it is one of the ways in which Nichiren Buddhism has been painted with a little bit of a negative brush at times.
Oh, so the rap on it is people are chanting this thing in order to, you know, make money or whatever.
That has definitely occurred, and I see it, you know, in a lot of people, and I see, you know, people who are, you know, they're maybe chanting for the wrong reasons, absolutely. Huh. And they do have this sense that it's sort of this magical, mystical thing that's going to, you know, it's going to help bring them wealth. It's sort of like the people who think of Christianity like the prosperity kind of gospel I mean, that stuff to me is total nonsense. And but I also think that if that's the thing that gets them to start practicing, and then, you know, I think that if they continue to practice, that will change.
But let's unpack this for just a second, because you said that one of the big impacts for you was you started, you were too shy to really get up on stage, and then 7 years later you had a Grammy nom. Yeah. So that does seem to put it within the context of success, but there's another way to think about it, which is that it was more about fulfilling your potential.
Yeah, absolutely, and fulfilling something that was within me, but that I think was really blocked in many ways. And that's a lifelong struggle. You know, as you know, like you're constantly bumping up against these things inside yourself that are real, you know, that can be hard to overcome. And so, you know, Buddhist practice for me has been one consistently effective way of doing that. I wish I was a better practitioner and a more consistent practitioner of it. But I know it's, you know, it's there.
Do you think the syllables have some sort of power in and of themselves, or is it just the act of chanting? Could you be chanting the ABCs?
Yeah, no, I do think there is a distinction. I have asked that question of, some people who I consider to be some very wise older men and women many times. And I do think that if you just sat there and chanted Coca-Cola over and over, there would be a very different effect. Because we are talking about the law of cause and effect. And, not to go too deeply into the kind of doctrinal.
No, go deep, man. You're in a safe place. You can go deep as you want.
So, you know, Nam-myoho Renge Kyo is the title of the Lotus Sutra. And so when you say Nam-myoho Renge Kyo, it's kind of devotion to the great and wonderful Lotus Sutra. That's the like literal translation of it. But the Lotus Sutra kind of says two things. It says two really important things. It says every human life has a Buddha nature within it. Okay, so everybody, no matter who you are, where you're from, no matter how awful or foolish or wonderful or beautiful or not, everyone has this Buddha nature within you, and it's something that you can manifest. And then the second thing it says is that Buddha nature is sort of infinite in both directions. So it's something that's always existed and will always exist kind of through time. And so not to get into, again, this is like a huge philosophical Buddhist concept of kind of the infinity of time and space and, you know, the kind of vastness of time and space and how this kind of connects to your own Buddha nature. And when I think through your practice, you are able to connect to this understanding of the universe as this truly huge thing with all this great potential power. So
that's just awesome.
Yeah. I mean, it's not something that's like, it doesn't happen every day, but I think it's something that you do experience at times, and it's quite profound.
Yeah. If you're getting that out of it, it seems like it's inherent. It's a valuable thing to do.
Yeah. It's great. It's great.
This show is brought to you by BetterHelp. I got to tell you, I feel so much better when I talk about my anxiety instead of keeping it bottled up. There's an expression that I first heard from the great researcher and also Zen practitioner Robert Waldinger, never worry alone. Our temptation many times is to keep it bottled up, but the data really show that the people who do the best in life, who live the longest and are the happiest, have strong relationships with people with whom they can talk about whatever's going on in their lives. And for me, therapy is part of that. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you might give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/happier today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/happier. As they say at Amica, empathy is our best policy. Whether you need auto, home, or life insurance, they're ready to help you protect the things that matter most to you. They're a mutual company, customer-owned, in service to you. Amica representatives are here when you need them, and you can take comfort knowing a real person will be there on the phone to take care of you, because the greatest measure of their success is your satisfaction. How have Buddhist themes shown up in your songwriting?
Yes, and sometimes more explicitly than I wish they had. Like, I'm slightly, not embarrassed, but there's some things that are on my first couple records that I just feel like are so, they're so kind of obvious in a way. And I never, like, you know, again, like when I think about people, where any music that's preachy in any way, shape, or form. I really don't like it at all. And so I've really tried to avoid that. But there are some, you know, there are certainly songs that have a lot of Buddhist themes and some kind of Buddhist imagery within them. And again, I'm like I feel a little bit embarrassed about it, but it's what I did when I was in my 20s, you know.
I think you can get a pass. You're in your 20s. Dealing with a big wave of early success.
Yeah.
And so I would imagine it just throws one up against a lot of these themes of desire and I would imagine primarily desire.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's funny because also, I mean, in Nietzsche and Buddhism, there's this idea that earthly desires equal enlightenment. And I know that that sounds crazy probably to many people. But there is this sense that if you didn't have desire, then you wouldn't you'd have no motivation to kind of do anything. So it's you know, I think there is this process in your practice where your desire, not that your desires become purified, because that sounds very puritanical, and Buddhism is not that at all, but your desires become kind of clearer, and the things that are going to make you truly happy, those things become clearer. So yeah, of course, you know, in my 20s and, you know, the things that I was excited about, you know, were really obvious things, you know, like hanging out with models and, you know, making money and having nice cars and nice apartments and recording studios and all that. And, you know, of course, those, you know, I wasn't immune to that by any stretch. But I do think at a certain point, the things that make you truly happy become clearer. And certainly, like, through, you know, when I sit down to chant now, you know, it's really about, like, can I write a piece of music that's going to affect somebody's heart? You know, is it going to take them to some mysterious, unexpected place when they hear this music that they didn't know they had it in them? And if I can do that, you know, that's the thing that that really means the most to me.
So desire, this theme of desire, there's a, I don't know if I can speak about this with any cogency, but Dr. Mark Epstein, who's a friend of mine and a previous guest.
Friend of mine as well.
Okay, you know. Okay, so you, yeah. Okay. Okay, yeah. So Epstein wrote a book called Open to Desire,
yes,
in which he tries to sort of invert the denigration of desire that is very common in mainstream Buddhism, which is,
yes,
desires like the enemy.
Yes.
But actually, and again, I don't know if I can restate this accurately, and I might get an angry phone call from Mark here, but he says that basically, you know, desire is important. It is what gets you out of bed, and it can be something also to watch with mindfulness and investigation to see how there's a poignancy in the fact that even when your desires are fulfilled, we're not fully satisfied.
Yeah.
And so to watch that is actually a source of potential wisdom. So this seems to be a very rich field that you've just touched on.
Yeah, I mean, not to go into too great detail, but I've had many long conversations with Mark about this and about my, you know, my own desire for, you know, for drinking and drugs and, you know, sex and money and, you know, all these things that we do get wrapped up in, you know, in this, you know, New York City world that we live in. He, you know, what was great about Mark was that he was just so calm and so kind and so compassionate and so non-judgmental.
Exactly, non-judgmental.
That, and just saying, you know, like you just said, just kind of look at it and try and understand where it's coming from and let it pass.
So I know a little bit about desire for drugs, and I read, and I could be wrong about this. So you correct me. Did you go to rehab for a little bit?
I did.
And so this was back in like 2011.
Yes.
So the practice of Buddhism, it's not going to solve all of your problems, and this would be an interesting case study.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, it was a very intense time for me. It was kind of a couple years after the success of Spring Awakening. And I think, you know, myself and my collaborators all kind of thought that after that show, everything was going to be easy street after that. You know, like all the opportunities were going to come and the show was going to run for 10 years. But, you know, a lot of things happened where that just wasn't the case. And I found myself, you know, all of a sudden kind of, you know, living the life I always wanted to live. And, you know, I had all this money in the bank and I was really like happy. And all of a sudden it was, you know, 3 years later, it was gone, you know. And
why?
A combination of factors. But, I sold some real estate. I bought some real estate. I spent a lot of money building a recording studio. I wasn't being careful with, you know, my just lifestyle in general.
And the show didn't run as long as
and,
you thought.
Yeah, and, you know, there were a lot of things that were supposed to kind of happen that didn't happen. And I found myself just kind of, you know, I was like really depressed. And, the next show that I wrote called Whisper House, which is a show that I'm really proud of, and it's actually going to be staged in London this spring. But, you know, we did it at the Old Globe in San Diego, and it didn't transfer to Broadway. And, you know, like all these records I was making, I was like having to make these records and make them kind of on my own dime. And I wasn't making that much money from touring. And it was just sort of like it just sort of evaporated the course of a few years. And I was, I was doing work that I was proud of, but it was just sort of like, what's going on? So I think, I was definitely drinking way too much to kind of, you know, just compensate for that or to kind of dull that, whatever it was, guilt or shame or, you know, self-criticism. But again, when I went to rehab, it kind of made me just feel like, I just need to practice more intensely. Mm. Like, you know, AA, as much as I admire and respect those folks, it's not what I believe in at all. And so it kind of brought me back to my practice again, so I'm very grateful for that.
Just to fill in some of the details that some listeners may not be familiar with, mm-hmm. I'll start this and then you can finish it because I will unquestionably run afoul of facts. Mm-hmm. So you transitioned at one point from being kind of like a 90s and 2000s era emo troubadour to writing for the stage.
Yes.
And Spring Awakening was a huge hit. Mm. And it was a remake of a German...
So it's based on a play that was written in 1891 by Frank Wedekind. And it's kind of thought of as the first German expressionist play. And it's a very racy piece about teenagers who are, you know, trying to understand the birds and the bees and the parents and the teachers and the clergy in their very kind of strict Lutheran environment, kind of bourgeois environment. They don't give them the necessary information. And then, you know, kind of all hell breaks loose in various ways. And so we did a version of the show where the scenes are set in 1891, but when the kids sing, they kind of become contemporary kids, and the music is, you know, alternative rock for indie rock, for lack of a better term. And at the time, it was a very, very groundbreaking thing because everyone said, "Oh, this show will never ever work. It certainly will never go to Broadway." You know, you might be able to do it off Broadway and do it on this kind of, you know, go to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival or something. But it did turn into this really interesting cultural moment, and it was great. It was a lot of fun.
And you've kept going with theater.
Yeah. So, it's hard to give you the list of all the things that are kind of in development. But recently, I just did American Psycho, which was also on Broadway.
Big Buddhist names in that, right?
Well, it's funny. I mean, American Psycho is a... I don't know that most people understood this, but it's a real critique of a lot of the values that kind of happen in the period of late capitalism. And so I do think of it as actually mm-hmm. very Buddhist in the sense that it's a critique of those things. But
I rescind my snarky remark. I rarely do that.
but you know, but it's also meant to be, and it's supposed to be an entertainment. And so I think one of the problems with American Psycho is that it was kind of trying to be many, many different things, and tonally it might have felt a bit uneven because of that, you know, where it's supposed to be funny and kind of outrageous and insane, but also moralizing on some level about, you know, about what happens when the only thing you care about are material things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There are legit Buddhist themes and explicit Buddhist themes, as I understand it, in Spring Awakening, which I apologize I've never seen.
Yeah.
But I've read you talking about it a little bit. Can you talk about it here?
Yeah. Well, so in Buddhism, there's this idea that at any given moment, you're kind of shifting through these 10 different life states. So hell, hunger, animality, anger, tranquility, rapture, learning, realization, bodhisattva, which is like compassion and enlightenment. And at any given moment, you're in one of these, inhabiting one of these states, and we all know what they are. Like, if you know, when you're in hell, you know you're in hell. When you're in hunger, you're in the state of desire. When you're, you know, just chilling in your house, you might be in a state of tranquility.
I'm mostly in animality.
Animality is, you know, yeah, it's a lot of people.
Yeah, I'm eating food out of a bowl on the floor.
No, but yeah, it's really, animality is more the state of being sort of like a sycophant, where you're kind of kissing up to people above you and kind of pissing on people below you.
Huh.
But anyway, so there are these 10 life states. And I think that really great pieces of art, whether it's a really fantastic movie or a really great play or a musical, I think that they are able to kind of show the human condition in all of those different life states.
Yeah.
And certainly in Spring Awakening, you do have all of those life states kind of represented. In terms of the, you know, what happens to these kids and their kind of reaction to it. And, you know, so you look at something like Les Mis, for example, you know, you have all of these really profound human emotions and they're all represented there. So,
Being a teenager is such an interesting time, I would imagine, as an artist to play with, because it's just like raw id on so many levels.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that's when, I mean, obviously, I care deeply about music, but that was when music affected me in the most kind of intense way. You know, when you're 15 and 16, and I have my, you know, headphones on, and I'm listening to, you know, some talk record or Depeche Mode record or whatever it was. Like, that was the most, you know, that was when it was like, oh, this song really changed my whole being.
Yes.
You know, so
it feels like I didn't plan to go here. I didn't. But what you're talking about is actually striking a chord with me, because music mattered so much to me, not only as a teenager, but even in my early 20s when I was starting out in TV news and I was living in Bangor, Maine, and listening to Guided by Voices records and Pavement records. And it felt to me like transmissions from a more sophisticated world and a connection to something bigger. And it really did. I don't know. I have meaning to that. I have trouble articulating.
Yeah.
What's interesting, though, as I'm now in my mid-40s, is I feel like it has a lot less meaning to me now.
I know. And I hesitate to say that's because there's not as much good music being produced now, because there are some really great records and really great bands out there. But you have to really look in the nooks and crannies to find them.
But you don't think it's an age thing where, you know, maybe other things have taken, you know, I have a kid now.
Yeah.
His music taste is terrible, by the way. His favorite song.
Does he listen to Kids Bop?
He listens to You've Got to Move It. I Like to Move It. What's that song? I Like to Move It, Move It, that song.
Okay.
That's his big. It's not even a kids song. It's just a terrible, like, techno song.
Yeah.
No offense to the Madagascar 5 who put that record out, I happen to know. But I just, I still listen to a lot of music, especially when I'm working out, and I still, like, Pitchfork is still the first thing I look at
you
in the morning,
because
I want to know what's coming out. But I feel like it doesn't have the meaning that it did to me, even in my late 30s. And I don't know, that maybe that's an idiosyncratic thing, or maybe it happens as you get older, and that's just kind of sad.
No, I think it's true. I think pop music has certain limits, has certain limitations. And if I, you know, now as a 46-year-old, if I'm looking for something that's really, really going to affect me in a deep way, I've got to be listening to Arvo Pärt or, you know, Steve Reich or some, you know, John Adams or some 20th century kind of classical composer that it's a little more musically nutritional, for lack of a better word. And I don't really necessarily find that in pop music, you know, because I've just, you know, I've grown out of it on some level. I mean, I still really love pop music, and there are certain things that can be fantastic. And, you know, I love Kendrick Lamar, and I love, mm-hmm. you know, some of The Weeknd, and I love some Kanye stuff.
Me too.
But
notwithstanding some of his Stranger Public pronouncements, yeah, he's a great musician.
Yeah, so I mean, it's not like I've divorced myself from it, but it's, you know, it serves sort of a very different function in a way. And I, you know, I love a lot of electronic music, but usually it's the more avant-garde stuff, and you know, things like Richie Hawtin and stuff like that. So
I find that it's playing like a utilitarian purpose, which is to like get me through 3 miles on the treadmill. Right.
And I understand that too. But that to me gets tiresome. But then again, you know, the last Radiohead record, it's gorgeous. I mean, it's really a piece of beauty. So people are still making great records. It's just they're not in the wider culture as much as they should be, is my opinion.
Right. What else, now that we've explored the depths of your mind, soul, and chanting abilities, what are you working on that we can go check out?
Well, so the main things, theater-wise, I'm working on is a stage adaptation of Secret Life of Bees, which is a hugely popular book by Sue Monk Kidd. And we should be hopefully workshopping that you know, in 2017. We have an amazing director, Sam Gold, and amazing writer, Lynn Nottage, and Susan Birkenhead doing the lyrics. It's a really great team. Doing an adaptation of Alice in Wonderland with Steven Sater, which is called Alice by Heart. I have a show called Noir that hopefully will be staged in 2017. And, you know, I'm actually trying next year to take a little time off, because this past year has been so busy, where I, you know, I put out a record last October, and I toured in November with Suzanne Vega, and I had two shows on Broadway, and it was just like way too much. So this year,
and you're trying to maintain a relationship, and
do all that good stuff. But I'm trying to, like, you know, I have some commitments this year coming up, but I'm trying to kind of take most of the year off, so to speak, but that really to like write the next Duncan Sheik record, and not have these things that are sort of like homework, but to, you know, just be involved in creative pursuits that are more pure, I guess you could say.
What a pleasure to sit and talk to you, man.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
No, the thanks goes from me to you for coming in. I really appreciate it. This is just, it's totally interesting. Is there anything, before I let you go, that I should have asked but didn't ask? Any other points you want to make? Anything else we should know about?
No, I mean, the only thing I was going to say was interesting, because I'll admit, like, I did a little research on you before I came in, and I watched the piece where you kind of talked about your, you know, anxiety attack. And it's funny, like, you know, one of the reasons I started, I recognized that immediately as something that plagued me. And, you know, it happened to me actually fairly recently. I was teaching, I was artist in residence at NYU at the Clive Davis School of Music. And it happened to me during a class.
Wow.
Where I was, you know, I had 30 kids there, and I just sort of like, oh, froze up, and I, you know, it's that thing where your throat clenches up,
oh,
and
yeah,
and it's like, it's this crazy thing, and actually that was one of the other things that got me to start practicing, because I was really kind of freaked out by the fact that could happen to me.
Your body can rebel.
So I feel like you're a real kindred spirit in that way, that we had this experience, and it's like, whoa.
There are a lot of us out there. Yeah. It is not, it's, you know, panic attacks are a real thing.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, just on your recent panic attack, had you had enough sleep the night before?
Probably not.
That can really do it.
Yeah.
There was a, My shrink, the guy who I went to after I actually had two panic attacks. The second one was much more mild.
Yeah.
And I've had plenty of panic attacks, but these were the two televised ones. Right. And after the second one, I went to this shrink at NYU, who's an expert in panic. And he really, first of all, he helped me point out that one major exacerbating factor was a little thing known as cocaine.
Oh, right.
So quitting that actually stopped the panic attacks, or really nip them in the bud in a big way.
Yeah.
But the problem is, once you learn how to panic, you get very good at it.
Yeah.
And what he pointed out is that the best way to deal with them is preventive. It's just preventive self care.
Yeah.
And he used an animal analogy that I sort of didn't remember it correctly. So a couple of years later, I went back to him and I was like, "Remember that time you said I should treat myself like a stallion?" Mm. And he said, No. I meant thoroughbred." And because I, of course, like a kitten looking in the mirror and seeing a lion, I, of course, thought he meant stallion.
Right.
But the point is, if you take good care of yourself, don't drink too much coffee, get enough sleep, exercise, all the annoying crap, the likelihood of a panic attack, I found, vastly diminished.
Right, right. Totally. I agree 100%.
But I'm sorry to happen to you recently.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, I think it's, it's something that, we have it inside us, and it's like a lifelong thing to kind of, to escape from that karma, perhaps.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree. Yeah. Duncan Cheek, thank you very much.
All right, thanks so
really much. Really appreciate
it. Cheers.
All right, there's another edition of the 10% Happier Podcast. If you like it, I'm going to hit you up for a favor. Please subscribe to it, review it, and rate it. I want to also thank the people who produced this podcast: Josh Cohan, Lauren Efron, Sarah Amos, and the head of ABC News Digital, Dan Silver. And hit me up at Twitter, Dan B. Harris. See you next time. If you like 10% Happier, and I hope you do, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.
I'm Shimon Yai, and I have a new podcast called The Competition. Every year, 50 high school senior girls compete in a massive scholarship competition.
I wouldn't say I have an ego problem, but I'm extremely competitive.
All of the competitors are used to being the best and the brightest, and they're all vying for a huge cash prize.
This will probably be the most intense thing you've ever gone through in your life.
I remember that feeling because I was one of them. I lost. But now I'm coming back as a judge and also a kind of teen girl anthropologist. Because if you want to understand what it's like to be a young woman in America today, the competition's not a bad place to start.
Hopefully no one will die on stage tonight.
From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.